Brother Terry Smith is here tonight, and he has invited a friend of his, Larry Malone, who will also share a story, and I got to hear that at the 545. You'll be blessed to do that. We've been talking the last 5 or 6 weeks about making a difference, being salt and light, different ways to do that. And whether it's driving in an RV, biking across America, or some of the things that they're going to talk to us tonight about sharing your story with others, we're called to do that as Christians. And you guys may remember Terry and his wife Charlotte were our presenters at our Winter Flame Marriage Retreat. I think it was 3 or 4 years ago. Time does have a way of passing by. And we're thankful for him being with us again. And he'll share a little bit more about what he's doing. He's now doing some life coaching and has devoted his life for a number of years in ministry in different capacities. So we're just thankful to have you, Terry and Larry. And the floor is yours. Encourage us. Bring us the word.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I just sat back here in the back and thought I'd chat with one of your older members and shook hands with Adam, and I said, "You know, I'm new here." And he said, "I am too." I said, "Adam, you just moved from Memphis here, right? Just walking down the street and looked up at your building. There's something about brought him in here." So I said, "You know, I want you to meet these folks, Adam. I want you all to meet Adam. Just in a few minutes, you meet a human being, and you know you've just met a real, he's the real deal, I can tell you." I'm glad you're here, Adam. It took a lot of courage for you to walk in here with all these white folks here. There's a few good folks that come from Seoul that I'd like for you all to meet Adam. He's here, and I'm grateful. And I'm grateful to be here. We're going to tell three stories tonight. And then at the end, we're going to have time for questions and observations. One of my greatest desires has been that I could tell my story to my grandchildren's children. And that's probably going to be impossible, but what motivated me, I've written a book, grew up in Mississippi. You know, Memphis is part of the Delta. The Delta begins in the foyer of the Peabody Hotel, going south to Mississippi, and I grew up in the Delta. So I've written a book called Delta Blues, Darkness to Light, Discovering Authentic Joy. And what prompted me to want to write the book, and I've had a lot of help when you read it, if you read it, you can tell Terry didn't do that. It's my story, but I had a lot of help. My best friend read it to his wife out loud, and she got to one chapter of the book, and she didn't want to hear it anymore, so I eliminated that chapter. So anyway, I'm going to read you just the beginning of the introduction, and that will lead me into a story that I want to tell you tonight. I had not seen Mama in 18 years. She was 45 years old. I was 26. Not knowing what to expect, I trembled inside. I had so many questions. What happened? The marriage breakup was never talked about. Why did Mama leave 4 children? Why was she so angry? Where was all the hatred coming from? There were so many buried feelings. The anger and hostility were so great we knew not to ask questions. As children, we were experiencing the pain like being hit when you didn't know it was coming. And then we got hit again. Secrets were discovered. A tragic life unearthed. And the pieces of the puzzle of broken lives came to light. There were two sides of the street in my early days. One side was chaos and darkness and a relationship in the process of dying. The other side was laughter, joy, safety, and love. The dark side of the street won out. Then my search for real life began. Hope entered in a gentle and quiet way. And I had to travel a journey from darkness to light. I will take you back to my beginning in the story. I'm going to just tell you one story tonight. Grew up in Memphis, over in West South Memphis, Frank Street. My mother was 16. My dad was 19. She had three children before she was 21. Let that soak in a little bit. We have four daughters and 10 grandchildren. And I spent all afternoon with the 10 grandchildren today. We were having a camp at our house from 17 to 1. And we had, what's that, whipped cream fights? Everybody got a whipped cream thing. And we cut loose on each other. I'm pretending you don't hit. But they, I would see them kind of sitting there like this. They were spraying each other. They were taking a little shot. But we had a grand time today. And but when I knocked on my mother's door in October of 1968, I'd driven a school bus past her house every day for 9 months. And I wondered what she was like and what was going on. So I knocked on the door, and Charlotte, my wife, was with me. And a man comes to the door and asks who I was. And I said, I'm Mildred's son. And so a few minutes later, my mother comes to the door, and she thought I was number four. I'm number two. And so she didn't really know who I was. And we began a journey. I knew that if I ever knocked on her door, I wasn't just going to knock on her door out of curiosity. I needed to hear a story. And my question, gone back when this was 1968. Well, in 1961, I was a student at Ole Miss. I remember I got drunk one night, and I woke up the next day, and I said, okay, your mother's an alcoholic, your granddaddy's an alcoholic, and I figured I was. And I was dying. Inside, I was dying. And I remember my grandmother, who had a third grade education, on her knees every night praying for us. And so I decided I would pick up the Bible. And I picked up the book of John. It took me 3.5 hours to read it. I got stopped on one line. And that was, I came to give life and I came to give it abundantly. And I said, he's a liar, or he's crazy, or he's telling the truth. And I'm going to have to find out. So I started going to church and was taken in by some really good people as I walked in. And the minister took me under his wing. Beautiful family, wife, three children. When he would speak, you could just see the fire in his eyes and his heart. And I said, okay, I got somebody that's going to show me. Because I didn't want to do to my children what was done to me. And they mentored me. And then tragedy hit. The minister and his wife got a divorce. She was having an affair with a doctor in town. And I said, oh my God, there's no hope for me. If the minister can't make it, how in the world is somebody as crazy as me going to find their way? Down deep inside, I learned something. There was a fire in my soul, and I'm going to find out what's real. I'm going to find out who this Jesus is. I'm going to find out how he put his pants on. I want to know how he got up in the morning. I want to know who he ran around with. I want to know what made the man tick. And so I got riveted on the story, and I wanted to know the story. And long story short, my mother, I ended up asking the big question was, is this really real? Could God really take a woman like my mother? And I went to the story in Jesus' life when he was at noontime stopping in Samaria. And he was thirsty, and his buddies had gone into town to get some food. And so he meets this woman at the well, and he asks her for a drink of water, as you know. And she bad-mouthed him. There's a racial issue there. She says, who are you asking me for a drink of water? He said, well, if you knew who I was, you'd ask me for a drink, and I'd give you living water. And she said, you don't even have a bucket. He said, the water that I give you, if you drink it, you'll never thirst again. Can you imagine? The lady says, you bet, I'll take some of that. And he said, well, go get your husband. And she said, I don't have a husband. He said, I know, I know. You've got five husbands, and the man you're sleeping with is not your husband. Treated her with dignity, didn't probe her sex life, honored her, treated her with high regard. And, of course, you know the story. She ends up going back and bringing the whole town out just to see him. He spends 2 more days in that city because of the way he treated this woman. And so when I met my mother, Lo and behold, she'd been married 5 times, and the man she was living with wasn't her husband. And my question was, does Jesus really work here? My first question back 8 years ago, when I was on the bottom looking up, was, can he meet somebody as crazy as me and give me life? And so I started paying attention to my questions. I want to know what's real. Religion doesn't work. But is this Jesus really the real deal? I was with my mother when she died. I walked 6 years with her after I met her, wrote my master's thesis of 6 years of walking with her with the question, can she make it? She had cut her throat. She had jumped out of a car going 80 miles an hour. She put a gun to her head and pulled the trigger. And the gun misfired, dropped it on the floor and blew a hole in the wall. She wanted to die. But you know what? I've discovered over the last 52 years is there's one thing that matters to God. Just one. I've narrowed it down to one. And that's a human being. It's the most valuable thing on this planet. And you squeeze a human being hard enough, there's something inside that fires, that rises up, that's larger than the pain. And so when she died, we sang to her. It's very interesting, right before, the year before she died. It takes a long time to get to real forgiveness. How do you get past abandoning 4 children? And part of the thing that's so important for us to get a hold of is to understand your story. And you know, I found out my mother's story. Her grandfather had 100 slaves, Adam, over in West Tennessee. After the Civil War, of course, they were all set free. And they had a big home like the Tara in Gone with the Wind growing up. And her father first wife died, and his baby died at birth. In his despair, he went to work as a riverboat captain on the Mississippi. While he was on the boat, one of his brothers, who got out of medical school, got a Dear John letter and shot himself. So things keep getting worse. So he goes back and he marries my grandmother, whose first husband had died, and she had triplets. And her brother, who was a doctor, attended to those triplets, and all 3 triplets died. And so what happened was my grandfather medicated his pain with alcohol. So when my mother was born, he was 53, my grandmother was 47, and my mother is born, guess who raised my mother? My grandfather, who's an alcoholic. So she got everything she wanted. She was never told no. Marries my dad at 16, has 3 children before she's 20 years old. When she had the 3rd one, I found out that the neighbors across the street who actually raised me took care of me. And so my first 7 years was full of joy and laughter. It was the custodian across the street, the janitor of the school, who had 7 children, and I became their baby. I was nurtured. My memories of childhood are being in the home of the Roseberry family, who was the janitor of the school. And so my first 7 years was joy and excitement and laughter. And all of a sudden, bam, Daddy goes off to war, World War II, comes back from the war, the grandmother buys them a home. And so you got 2 teenagers and they're having a big party. So one evening while they're having the party, what happens is my mother sees my daddy going out with her best friend, so she goes out with his best friend and she gets pregnant. That's the family secret that I found out. The uncovering, the torpedo that hit the ship that sank it, and the bitterness and the hatred that erupted out of that. I remember my mother standing on top of a 49 Ford, kicking the windshield in and cursing my daddy to hell. And as the children, we're just kind of, what's going on? What's happening here? We didn't know. And so I got that story when I found my mother. And you're talking about having trouble forgiving yourself? She had a lot of trouble. But a year before she died, she was in the hospital, and she got a picture of an old man sitting in a chair with a long beard. It's her view of God. And he had a twinkle in his eye, and his arms were stretched out like this. Like, come sit. And for the first time in all those years, finally got to her that God really meant it. That he forgave her. And so forgiveness is what this is about. I've just introduced you to one piece of the story. But the Jesus that I just sought, and you use the word seeking, Adam, you're seeking. The Lord never forsakes those who seek him. That's Psalm 4. Psalm 9:10. He never forsakes those who seek him. If you're a seeker, maybe you're in a good place. Because he never forsakes. And I watched him take that woman and open her heart over the years. And so I want to commend the story of Jesus to you. And the story of the woman at the well. There really is living water. And if you're thirsty, he's ready to give you a drink. Now I want to introduce you to Larry Malone. I met last August. He came walking into my office with a couple of CDs that I had done, given to him by one of my shepherds at Woodmont, on the story of Jesus through the eyes of Peter, and then my own story, and we began a relationship. Larry's a retired Navy captain, pilot, and I want Larry to come and tell you his story of how God came after him, and then I'm going to tell you another story, and we got the three of them together, and then we're going to open up for questions and observation. We've got on the back here, there's some material about Larry's story, some of my story, and then this book that I just finished, that if you're interested in looking about it. So Larry, come tell them the story.
Okay. He's going to pin it on me. Sounds painful. Good evening. Well, when I was a young boy, I grew up in a home that didn't give me everything I needed. Of course, that's familiar because there are no perfect homes. But I needed very early on to create an identity for myself that was going to work, get me kind of what I needed. And very early, my father, I'm a PK, but in this case, it's a principal's kid. Same idea, though, you know, authority figure, not a lot of difference. But my job in an early age was to act in such a way that nobody would think that I'm the PK. So that meant rebellion. For me, it meant a lot of speed. I loved things that went fast, and I very quickly kind of gravitated to airplanes. And so at a very early age, I started flying. I worked hard so that I could afford this addiction that I had. And 14 years old, I start flying airplanes. And 16, I get my first license. And I decided that I wasn't much of a student, but I did want to fly. So I buckled down and went to, at 17, I enrolled in aeronautical engineering course in school. Got my commercial and instrument rating when I was 18. My whole identity was shaped around being a pilot. And frankly, there wasn't much else there. I was married when I was 20 years old. Life was going very, very fast, and I was pretty much unconscious. The Vietnam War was going on, and I really wanted to fly, but I really didn't want to go. I didn't really want to go in the military, but I thought, you know, the best thing here is to go in the Navy flight program. So for two college summers, I went to the officer training for that. As soon as I graduated, my wife and my little baby boy, we had a Porsche at the time, nice family car, and we drive to Pensacola, and I'm really thinking I'm just pretty darn cool overall, but I was a shell. And I had this pilot identity. Went through the flight training program in the Navy and just burned it up. I mean, I was just the top student all the way along. Got my wings in 1971. They gave me a regular commission in the Navy. They also invited me into a program that would lead into the astronaut program, and they said you can fly any plane the Navy wants. So I picked the A-6 Intruder Bomber because the business of that plane was flying low and fast, and that's what I'd love to do. So I trained in that airplane on the West Coast up in the Seattle area. Did well in the training, and the Vietnam War, this is 1972, the Vietnam War is still going on, and of course it's all about going to war. So I found myself, when I was only 24 years old, as a young guy flying off the USS Enterprise, and I was kind of at the peak of what dangerous flying can be, because we were flying night, single plane, low level missions into Vietnam. And as a thrill junkie, I was getting plenty of it, but something was going on inside of me that wasn't pretty. I was having trouble sleeping, could only get a few hours of sleep at a time, didn't know why. About every second or third meal that I would eat, I was losing. Of course, I wasn't telling anybody about this. Friends dying, all the conflict of the war going on, that I've never processed any of it. I hadn't processed any life, frankly, at that point. I was just kind of a machine. But something was going on that was bothering me increasingly, and I didn't know what it was. Took off one night, headed for North Vietnam, and my bombardier just kind of casually mentioned something about, hey, think we're going to make it. And it was a highly defended route for a meaningless target, which was like a lot of those flights. And I just went, oh, man, wow. That was a question that I didn't even want to consider. But there was no time to consider because it was time to go in. Dropped that plane to the deck and hit the firewalls and just went in, and we were shot at and not hit. We hit the target, came back out, and now it's orbiting at 30,000 feet over the ship and 4 o'clock in the morning waiting for your time to land. And I'm going, oh, I am in trouble. The warning lights in my own system were going off, just like every red thing. And here's what I knew. I said, to do what I'm doing, I need to have really good, clear reasons to do this. I had none. What was going on in my mind were my wife, my little boy that I left, the baby that was in my wife's womb, the friends that were dying, the meaningless target that we had just been assigned to, the whole thing, nothing computed. So I made a decision, and I told my bombardier, I said, when we land this airplane, I'm going to rip my wings off and quit. And I did. Now, a complete stripping of identity. I didn't have another one. That was it. I did it to myself. And with all that that means, and then I did it without knowing why. Well, you'd think my Navy career was going to end right then, because, they can make you be in the military, but they can't make you fly a $30 million aircraft. It'd be stupid to do that. So, but that's what I did. But my career flourished after that, and I stayed in the Navy as an engineering specialist for the F-14 Tomcat aircraft. It's just that I wasn't flying it. But my heart had a hole in it, and it was completely unprocessed. And I was in a wilderness now, I know, for almost 10 years. Fast forward now, I decided after 3 cruises and 10 years in the Navy to get out because I didn't even know my family, and it was time to end that. So now we live in Northern California. I've got a great job, got a nice house and nice car, and everything looked good on the outside. I got an education, but I'm a mess inside, and I'm angry, and I'm hurt. And when I get into a quiet place, like driving a car where there's nobody else around, I find myself swearing. And what was really scary, I didn't have anything particular in mind. And so I thought, oh man, Malone, you're going nuts. You better get some help. Fortunately, I was in a place where I could get help. I had insurance, and I started psychotherapy with a union psychotherapist that was a great guy. He was, I did not have a faith at that point. And he was probably between an agnostic and an atheist, a typical therapist. So he wanted us, some of them are believers, but he wanted to get into the war right away, but I pushed back. Finally, there was enough trust there. I was finally ready, and after quite a while, he said, "Larry, now let's talk about the war again. What'd you do?" I said, "Well, I was a bomber pilot." He said, "Did you fly in Vietnam?" "Yes." "Did you drop bombs in Vietnam?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, how many people do you think you killed?" And I just instantly just wanted to, I wanted to kill him. I went, "Yeah." And then he saw my reaction, and he just said, "We better stay here for a while." And so he said, "Your homework is I want you to just give some kind of an estimate of that number." He said, "And get enough pennies to handle it." So I went down to the store and I got, I think, 8 rolls of pennies, which is like 400. And I have no idea. These are bombs, right? Yeah. So I cracked those things open and I got this big pile of pennies on this table. And I'm just looking at them going, and I go back and I say, "There they are. I mean, what am I supposed to do? I have no idea what to do." And he said, "Well, have you ever considered the moral consequences, your own personal moral inventory of what conditions need to exist for you to kill someone?" And I said, "No, I haven't ever done that." And he said, "Make sure that this is not what just that the country told you to do it. Make sure this is your own inner compass." So I came back in the next session. I said, "You know, I have an answer. I have three conditions I've found. That's the good news." And I said, "If somebody's going to kill me, I can kill them. If somebody's going to kill another person, someone I love, I can kill them. And the third one is, if somebody's actually going to keep me from being a free man, I could kill them." I said, "But here's the bad news. None of the conditions were met." And the room just goes, and my therapist, and I love this man for what he was brave enough to say, he said, "Larry, what you have here is not a psychological problem. This is a spiritual problem." And the word that was hanging in the room that was unspoken was forgiveness. What am I going to do with this? This is my inventory. This was personal. This was my conclusion. What am I going to do with this? So I left that afternoon. I did a Hail Mary to God. I did a Hail Mary to a God that I didn't really even believe. I really found out later that I thought I had a problem with God, but what I really had was a problem with a religion, and actually I still kind of have that. So, but I said, "God, if you're there, if there's ever a time when I need to hear from you, it's now, because I am in the deepest kind of trouble. You see, I have these pennies. And this therapy that I was involved in involved dream analysis, and he taught me how to journal, and I was paying attention, all that stuff. But that night, in a dream, I had a dream that didn't need any interpretation, because here's what happened. Jesus Christ came to me in the dream, told me who he was, told me he knew exactly how much this hurt. He told me also that he was ready, willing, and able to take me right on through this thing with him all the way. But he said, come now." It was really clear. The very next morning I was driving to work as I normally do, and there was a church nearby that ends up being a friend's Quaker church. And I, of course, never darkened the doors of this place. Faith wasn't part of my life. But there was, however, a pastor that oftentimes was driving into, at about the same time I went to work, he typically was driving to work. And he just looked like the pastor of the place. He had kind of white hair and stuff. And so that morning, he happened to be right, he had big hair, you know, big. That morning, I happened to be right behind him, as the Lord would have. By the way, the Lord's chasing me here, in case you can't tell. I pulled on in behind him. And as he's getting out to go into his office, I said, "Hey, got a minute?" And I told him about the dream. He looked at me, he said, "You know, usually I have to work harder for this." He said, "Boy, you ready?" And I said, "Yes." And that was, and I just hit the floor, okay. And isn't it interesting that those are Mennonites, Amish, Quakers. They're all pacifist, right? And so who do I bring my... But, of course, the very first thing that I brought to Jesus was, oh, the pennies. Oh, I'm so sorry. And that became the beginning of the walk where God, about 10 years later, even got me to the point where self-forgiveness came. And the very first thing that God spoke to me, like I needed a lot of, I'm a 2x4 Christian, by the way, and that means, bam, you know, you really get this guy's attention. So the very first verse he ever gave to me was, be still. That was a command, and no, I'm God. God was telling me the very first thing that I needed to learn was that I needed a lot of quiet time with God. And that would be about, for me, about as contrary a thing as anybody could imagine. That's not what I do. And my worst nightmare is a prayer closet. Okay? So, but that was the invitation. And God has progressively administered an unimaginable amount of love into what I now know is a soul wound. What I had was a soul wound that was killing me. And I know that people have soul wounds that kill them. And I know that the answer is progressive exposure to an unimaginably kind and loving God. That at the beginning of this and at the end of this just simply loves you now like you are. May God bless you all. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you.
One of the things that is happening with Larry and me now is in our world, every hour, tell us what's happening, Larry.
Every hour, a random person recently returning from combat or in the military experience, typically having to do with killing, is killing themselves. And every hour, three of them try it. It's an epidemic. It's getting worse. And they don't know what to do with, because it's beyond PTSD. Because it's a soul wound, the love of God only will heal.
I'm going to go to one other story, which is the backdrop of this. And I'm going to sort of do this quickly. And I'm going to do it like this. The Apostle Paul met Peter for the first time. It talks about in Galatians. And he spent 15 days, Peter and Paul, together. What do you think the question Paul asked Peter when they got together? What was it like to be with him? And so I'm going to take about 10 minutes, and I'm going to be Peter, and I'm going to tell you what I think Peter would say in about 10 minutes of what it was like to be with Jesus. And then we're going to open it up for some conversation. First time I became aware of Jesus, I'd been fishing all night long, and this guy comes up, and a lot of people with him. I've heard about him, lame, walk, blind, could see. And he comes up to my boat, and he asks if I could get in my boat. And I let him in, and he started talking to people, and then he stopped, and he said, let's go fishing right over there. I said, there's no fish over there. I've been fishing all night long. He said, let's go right over there. So we, you know, moved the boats out, dropped our nets in, and lo and behold, the nets started jerking. We filled my boat low, and then we called another guy over and filled, and we almost sank. Something happened in me in that moment that had never quite happened before. I looked at him, and I fell on my face. I said, get away from me. I'm not worthy to be in your presence. And then he said, ever so gently, don't be afraid. Follow me. And I'll make you a fisher of men. Well, you know, that's it for me. I dropped my nets and started following him. He picked up a couple of other guys. James and John were a couple of rich kids. Father owned a fleet of boats with hired servants. They came along. And there was Matthew, the tax collector, and Simon the Zealot over here would have cut his throat in a heartbeat because he was a part of a militant group that hated anybody that would line up with the Romans. And so we began to move out in the villages. The lame walked and blind could see. And one night, he left us. And all night long,
He was gone. And he come back early in the morning, and he walked over to me, and he said this, "I want you with me. And I want you to go out into the villages, and I want you to tell people that the kingdom is near. And I'm going to give you the authority to cast out demons. Do what I did." And he picked up James and John, couldn't believe that. Matthew, the tax collector, and Simon the zealot. And we began to move around the villages with him. And it was astounding. He was brilliant. And he had talked about lampstands and mustard seeds. You see, what was going on in Israel, at the Galilee particularly, every spring of the year, somebody would claim to be the Messiah, get him a couple of hundred men, and storm Jerusalem. Take him out, just like that. And we were on the move. And we knew the kingdom was near. About 6 months before he was killed, we'd been out in the villages. He gave us the authority. He anointed us. The lame walked and the blind could see. We were doing the same things that he was doing. And a crowd was massing. And he got word that John the Baptist had got his head cut off. And so he said, "We need to get some rest." We got in the boat, went across the sea, and when we arrived on the other side of the lake, there were 5,000 men waiting. And he looked at them, and I could see it in his eyes, and it was tears. He said, "They're like sheep without a shepherd." And you know the story, fed 5,000. But that wasn't the big deal. The big deal is that we were organized in groups of 50 and 100. We knew that we had more men on the backside of that desert than there were Roman soldiers in Palestine, and we could have done it. We could have taken them out in a heartbeat. And you know what he said to me? He turned to me and he looked me right in the eye, and then he looked at the rest of us and he said this, "Get in the boat and get out of here." Very curt. Immediately we got in the boat and headed across the lake. We watched him walk into the crowd and the crowd began to dismiss, and then we watched him run up into a ravine alone. His popularity went right down the tube after that, particularly over across the lake. When he started talking about, "If you're going to follow me, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood." When he said that, I just sneered. Oh, God. Because everybody left him. Then he turned to me and says, "What about you, Peter? You also going to leave me?" And I looked at him and I said, "Where can I go? There's nobody like you." I'll tell you what really hurt me, and I didn't know what to do with this, and you can tell when I tell you this. He said to me, "I am going to Jerusalem. And the chief priests and the rulers are going to spit in my face. And they're going to mock me. And they're going to crucify me." It was like he took a knife and drove it right in the center of my gut and lifted it. And I just rose up and I said, "No, that'll never happen. Not on my watch." And he looked at me and he said, "Satan, you get behind me. You think like men and not like God." Well, it got silent. He took me and James and John up on the mountain, and there were the three biggies. There was Moses, and there was Elijah, and there was Jesus standing. My knees began to shake. I said, "Wow, let's build something here." And all of a sudden, a cloud came over all of us, and I heard this voice from God that said, "This is my Son, whom I love. Listen to him." God talking right there. Listen. It's good timing. Listen to him. When we headed down the mountain, we were talking about this experience because he had these glowy white Moses left the line. There he stood. And we started talking about it. He said, "Guys, I want you to keep your mouth shut about this. Don't talk about this event until after the resurrection." So we get down to the bottom of the mountain, and there's an epileptic boy foaming in the mouth and rolling in the fire. And the father runs up to Jesus and he says, "If you can, will you help my son?" And Jesus said, "What do you mean, if I can? With God, nothing is impossible. Heal that boy." Later on that evening, we were sitting around the fire and I said, "What? Why couldn't we help the boy?" And Jesus said, "Only by prayer. Only by prayer." He did this a couple of more times. Said he was going to die. We were confused, arguing about who's the greatest. He goes to the little children. Says it again, "I'm going to die." We were confused, arguing about who's the greatest. James and John pulled him aside and said, "You know, we're number one here, one and two, Jesus. We want your right and your left." And we ticked us off. Who are those upstarts, you know, think of they? And then he went to a blind man on the side of the road. And then the night came when he washed our feet. And he got to me and he said, "You're not washing my feet." And he said, "Peter, if you don't let me wash your feet, you've got no part in me." And I said to him, "Don't just wash my feet, wash my head, wash my hands." And he said, "You've already had a bath today. I just want to wash your feet." And then he said something I'll never forget. He looked at me and the rest of it. He says, "Every one of you will leave me. No one will stand." And I looked around. I knew they were a bunch of pantyweights. They wouldn't stick with him. But I said, "Jesus, they may leave you, but I'll die for you. I'll go to prison for you." And he said, "Oh no. Tonight, you will turn against me three times before the cock crows." And sure enough, soldiers came. He spent 3 hours in prayer, asked us to pray with him, and we all went to sleep. And he said, "Couldn't you watch just an hour?" Soldiers came. I pulled a sword out. I tried to rip a guy's head off, cut his ear off. Jesus picks the ear up, lays it back on his head, and says this, "I could have called down 12 legions of angels if I wanted to fight this war that way." And they took him off. And we followed him. I got in the gate because I had a friend, and they thought I was one of them. I said, "I don't know the man." Went by the fire and was warming. They said, "Oh yeah, you are. You're one of those disciples." He said, "I don't know the man." Third time, a woman said, "Oh yes, you are. I can tell by your accent." And I began to curse and swear. I never knew the man. The cock crowed, and there stood Jesus looking at me with blood coming down his face. And something went through me like fire. And everything in me broke into 1,000 pieces, and I wept. And I saw myself for the first time. We stopped there. We all know, 3 days later he rose. You know where he went? First place Jesus went. He went and found Peter on Sunday afternoon, alone, locked in a room. And this is what I know he said peace to him. But I think he put his arms around him and said, "I know. You're okay with me. You're okay with me." I want to make one point about this, the backdrop of everything we're saying. If Jesus would stick with Peter, who for 3.5 years missed the point entirely, when you discover in your soul wound of your failure, of your brokenness, of your deep inability to forgive yourself, if God would stick with Peter, will he not stick with you? And so we have three stories. We got my little story, Mary's little story, and Peter's little story. And then you've got your story tonight. So come on, Larry, let's y'all got any observations, questions? Let me take a few minutes here. We know, I think we've done our time. Any comments? Didn't this blow your mind? Isn't this beyond comprehension? Don't you hear Jesus praying before they murder him? "Father, help them understand you love them as much as you love me." There is no place in your brain that can compute from a human point of view the magnitude, the passion, the indescribable, inexpressible love of God that was demonstrated. And that's the story. Oh my God, that's the story that we want to get out. And believing it is the big deal. When you wake, you know what Larry said about the stillness? Be still and know that I'm God. You know one of the things that connects me to this guy? He awakens every morning, and the first thing he does is drop to his knees. Because there is a viewpoint here, ladies and gentlemen, of a God who's inviting us into communion, into personal, intimate fellowship with the Creator of the universe, who knows your name. He's got it written on his hand. And that's a decision that I make every single day to believe that, because that's outside the box of religion. It's outside the box of the human point of view. It's the only hope for these young men and women who are living in a culture where God is not even a question in the culture that we're living in. And people are left with their own hearts that condemn them. You know what the Fogo says? I found the enemy, and the enemy is?
Us.
Yes, it's us, me. Yeah.
You know, mine is a story of identity, a stripped identity. And I wrote a little poem to God related to my identity that I'd like to share with you. And it goes like this. It says, I'm not who I say I am. And I'm not who you say I am. I'm not even who you say that I say I am. I am who I am, says I am, beloved. And the most amazing part of this thing is this thing starts and ends with the same word, love. That's what started you, love. That's what ends and finishes you, love. And if you spend time with this God that we're talking about, I'm talking about quiet time. I'm talking about listening time. I'm talking about literally climbing up into the lap of God and getting loved on until you just can't hold anymore. Because that's what we need. But what you're going to find at the absolute core of your identity, is beloved. Loved. And what's so amazing is it's always right now, exactly where you are and how you are. It's never withheld for something that you're going to become later on. It's full on, it's radical, and it is beyond our comprehension. But it's true, and it's there.
I know our time is up. Let me just close it with this. Neither my father nor my mother sought God. And I lived in desperation from age 7 to 18. So when I got drunk that night at Ole Miss, when I woke up the next day and I said, well, my mother's an alcoholic, my granddaddy's an alcoholic, I figured I was. And I was dead in the water. I was dying inside. And when it took me 3.5 hours to read the book of John in the King James Version. And I never read a book. I read one book before I got out of high school. But I read that book because I was dying inside. And the line that stuck was, I came to give life, and I came to give it abundantly. I said, he's a liar, or he's crazy, or he's telling the truth. And I'm going to find out. Ministered and his wife divorced in front of me, and I said, my God, if the preacher can't make it, there's no hope for me. There was a riveting thought in my soul. He said, let no man be your teacher. You test everything. So this is what I believe. I believe human beings are absolutely phenomenal. You squeeze a human being hard enough, fast enough, there's something inside the soul of man that rises up and says, that's enough. Because you're larger than your pain. And everybody in this room tonight has a soul wound, a deep soul wound. And the good news that I would say to you, at least hearing Larry and I, who never met until a year ago, that God knows your story. He knew the story of the woman at the well. He knew Larry's story. He knew Peter's story. And by George, he knows your story. And I could be right. I just might be right. And when you go home tonight and you go to bed and you lie on your bed, I'm not going to ask you to pray. I ask you to reflect. Just reflect that what you just heard tonight might be true. And that God is leaning forward in your life. Led you to kind of walk in tonight, Adam, amongst the people who are seeking God. They're not perfect, I guarantee you. They're a mess. I can just look at them here. This is a messed up bunch. But they're no different from Peter or Larry or me. But they're on the journey and they're seeking and they're hungry. Or you don't come to church on Wednesday night and not be hungry for something for your soul, right? Can I hear amen? Find where would you come to church on Wednesday night? Good night. But you're getting a word from the God of the universe who is seeking you. every single day. Jesus said it, and I'll close with this. This minister gave me this passage. I memorized it 52 years ago. And I thought about it and reflected on it a lot. Jesus said, "Come to me, all of you who are weary and heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and lowly in heart, and you'll find rest for your soul. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Translated into my language, he said, Jesus is your teacher, and he is ready to teach you if you will come and seek him. So, bless you. Thank you, Larry. Thank you for sharing. And are you closing this thing out? Thank you, guys. Y'all have been very kind to listen to us tonight.
Thank you guys so much. Here we are sharing your story and being transparent with us. This has been, I mentioned this at the early part, this has been a tough couple of days, I know, for our church family. And it's good to be together. And it's good to have you with us if you're visiting for the first time. And this may sound kind of trite, but we have some watermelon and things prepared. You think about it, it's like, oh, that's giving the snacks and food. But the thing that happens out there is kind of amazing. You know, when Christians, especially here at Antioch, I think, gather and we open up and we share and we talk about our stories and talk about our weeks. So invite you to take part in that and get to know us better and reconnect with some folks. I'm sure we'll see many of you guys in the next few days here at the building with Brother Junior's visitation and funeral. And information on that and how you can support their family is in the bulletin that you probably picked up coming in. So let's stand and pray. Ask a blessing on these two guys and thank you again for coming. And our Father, we thank you for today. Each day is a gift from you. We thank you for giving us strength when we need it, for giving us challenges when we need it, for giving us each other to be a part of a body. Lord, we thank you for those that have come tonight, maybe for the first time. I've met several people, Father, and I just pray that you will encourage them and bless them. Father, help our fellowship time to be not just surface talk, but to be encouraging, to be connecting, to be sharing our stories, the stories of our life. But I thank you for Brother Terry and Larry and for their transparency and willingness to open up those wounds to us and teach us. And Father, we think about the Grimes family, and we love them, and we miss Brother Junior, and we thank you for the role that he's played in our lives. And we look forward to being with him and with you and the other saints, Father. And we thank you for this day. It's through Jesus we pray. Amen. God bless you guys. We'll see you soon.